We're not off this week. We're actually doing development. We're all getting together in person, our whole team, some of whom are flying in, and we're just like talking about what we want to do on this show in the year ahead and how we're going to outdo ourselves and how we're going to do our best work. All of which is to say we're not making a new show this week, but we're going to play you an old one that a lot of people here seem to enjoy. I don't know why. It's called The Interrogation of Jesse Brown by my fremenesis, Jonathan Torrance. Enjoy.
Well, hello, Canada Land listeners. You might be wondering, where's Jesse? I don't know this high-pitched nasally whine. Well, as I can only assume you're all relieved to have a break from him, you're welcome. He'll still be here today, but this time, there's a bit of a twist. My name is Jonathan Torrance, and today, I'll be hosting The Interrogation of Jesse Brown. Or maybe it's more like an intervention. For longtime listeners, you might remember that Jesse and I have a bit of a history. 100% grade A Canadian beef that goes back millennia, or at least to the mid-90s, which is the first instance I can recall of Jesse trolling me on the teen talk show I hosted, Jonovision.
This afternoon, Jonovision on CBC.
Maybe it's more like a what's your beef for you Street Sense kids out there. Anyway, he was there to talk about his underground student newspaper called Punch. But over time, he revealed his true intention to enlist fellow guest Sarah Pauly's help to derail the whole show. Despite Jesse's constant need to be that guy, be the bully on the cyber playground, 3 years ago, I agreed to come on this show and be trolled in front of all of you. This time, I agreed to come back on one condition. I be the one to interview him. This is my chance to ask all the questions I've been dying to have answered. Okay, two questions really. What is wrong with him? And why is he so angry all the time? So today I'll be putting the screws to the enigma that is Jesse Brown to find out what makes him tick and what makes him ticked. Is the Jesse Brown we all think we know the same guy when the mic is off? Let's find out together. Hey.
Hey.
How are you today?
I'm doing okay.
Which one of us is Balky and which one is Larry?
I'll be, what was the actor's name? I'll be Bronson Pinchot from True Romance. I'll be that Bronson Pinchot.
Bronson Pinchot. Oh, I like him. Jesse Brown joins us now in the house that he built. I'm trying to gauge your tone. Is it argumentative? Are you nervous?
I'm like, scanning the lay of the land here. I don't know what I'm walking into.
Dozens of Canadians insisted that we revisit this conversation in a part two. And I thought it would be fun to turn the tables and have a chance to get to know Jesse Brown a little bit. So when this possibility came up, how did you feel about it, first of all?
Like, my hesitation is just, I don't know that anybody cares. Maybe you're asking if I, like, am I nervous about it? I don't know. No.
I think asking the questions is kind of a default for me just in life. I ask it to get out of social situations. I ask questions to deflect from myself. So I guess I'm trying to find common ground. Do you too experience cringiness at the thought of people listening to you blather on?
I think it would be disingenuous. Like I subject many people to my blather in you know, professional and personal situations. So I think I'm just too aware of the collective eye roll of many who know me listening. If I were to say yes, I can't stand to make somebody listen to me talk for a very long period of time.
And yet, when Amy Dempsey wrote an article about me and whether I was okay during the pandemic because I seemed unreasonably chipper, you were the one counterpoint who represented the eye rollers of Canada who roll their eyes at me. Why is it you think people would roll their eyes at you?
I am a podcast listener, right? And I think of the podcast listening experience for everything else we try to do. Like, this is a very important show about current affairs, or this is the only show that's... It's just people deciding who they want to spend time with when you listen to a podcast. You're just deciding which of the hosts of all the different podcasts you want to hang out with. And as a listener myself, I know that you reach a saturation point where it's like, I've hung out with Marc Maron enough, you know, like it's been great. but I know what he's going to say. I've heard it all. Let me find somebody else to hang out with. And I wonder about my best before date.
Well, the funny thing is, I cited a Ricky Gervais anecdote when I was speaking with Sarah and Jonathan, your team, before this, about the bulletin board in a town. And Jonathan said, yeah, you mentioned that last time. And I encounter this too. I have a podcast. We're approaching 300 hours. And I've started calculating the number of anecdotes I preface with, you and I have talked about this before. Like, at what point do you say that's enough of me?
Like, you want a date or a number of episodes? What are we talking about?
Well, no, it sounds like this is something that's reverberating around in your head as well.
Even as I was saying that thing about listening to Marin and deciding who to hang out with, I'm like, have I said that on the podcast before? This is actually what you asked me about when you tried to turn the tables on me in our last conversation. Was just like, I don't know if you were as ungenerous as to call it a shtick, but I think you were questioning me about my ornery disposition and whether or not I'll run out of orneriness and not be able to do anything else. I don't know if it's orneriness, but I do feel like... So we've been trying to like make it less me. And on the Monday show, what's interesting about it for me is all the different people and all the different stories that we're now featuring. But yeah.
So that's the option, Jesse? Have more people who are less ornery rather than you? Just simply be less ornery?
No, I'm looking for people who are ornery in different ways. Like, my favorite people are very ornery. And it's a bad habit for a person in a hiring position at a company that they, like, mostly own to specialize in hiring angry people and critical, cynical people. But that seems to be my thing. And I'm just sort of interested in, like, you know, different flavors of ornery.
I have so many questions. Mostly it has to do with... And I can't remember if I mentioned this last time I was on. I was thinking of Tom Green, who, when he was coming up, would have human feces on a microphone doing streeters. And then he would have a dead raccoon in a suitcase. And every time he did something, he had to ratchet up the audaciousness. And I know for a fact that put kind of a lot of internal pressure on him. And I wonder if the anger balls of the world feel that same kind of pressure to be even angrier.
What can I possibly have to be angry about? I mean, things have gone like pretty okay for me. I don't know. I feel like you only experience me, like, I don't know how much you listen to the show. So I feel like our chief intimacy, you and I, are my mocking, withering tweets that just destroy you when you least expect it, when you're saying earnest, lovely things. But, you know, I guess all journalism is about like a certain amount of this is wrong and here's what it's all about. We found something that's wrong. That should be informed by a certain amount of anger, but the anger isn't really what sells it. So it's not like we sit around like, how can we get it angrier? There's like an element in criticism of like, if I'm going to take issue with something, I got to mean it.
Is that what gives you oxygen?
There's different things. Like, if I actually am pissed off about something, I'll have a lot to say about it. And it's an interesting challenge because the things that I get pissed off at are pretty esoteric and niche. So, you know, speaking to kind of a general audience of smart people who might not give a damn about the thing I'm angry about, it's kind of like, I like when I'm like, how can I convey my irritation in a way that will get other people angry about this? That can give me some juice, yeah. But there's nothing like a good story.
What makes you angry? Like, what are the things that are niche?
Oh, man. I mean, I think that the project of the show and the company, in a way, is to try to take this place that we're living in seriously and not just kind of consider ourselves like bystanders to news and history and the real world, that we just like think of ourselves, oh, we're in the nice place off to the side of the big bad place. So, you know, the kind of operating principle is like, look at your own home and regard it for real. And it's not something that I used to do before Canada Land. It's not like I spent, you know, the first 30 years of my life really building up any kind of like fixation, obsession, or even deep knowledge of Canada. But with the project of Canada Land, there's no shortage of things that get you pretty irritated. You know, I think that the thing that's frustrating is we live in such a low engagement society, whether it's like the voting levels in Ontario or just trying to get people to take themselves seriously and our policies, each other. That is frustrating. That's irritating. And how much powerful people get away with just out of apathy. If you regard it, if you look at it right at it, it's endlessly frustrating.
So that's your beef with me. You think I don't take things seriously enough. I'm too surface. I'm too upbeat and happy. I kind of gloss over the deep stuff.
I thought we were talking about me. No, I don't think that's my beef with you.
First of all, how often do you introduce yourself as Jesse Brown, former Jonovision guest? Just on average in the run of a week.
Yeah, it never comes up. It's never come up. You know, no one remembers.
Right.
It meant nothing.
For me either. But when you were on the Jonovision, I feel like, were you 18 years old?
Yeah.
You were talking about the student newspaper Punch, of which you were the editor.
Mm-hmm.
You proudly posted a quote from a principal that called Punch obscene and destructive.
Mm-hmm.
So the seeds were there early on for this to be your path in life. Like, most teenagers aren't as engaged or as worked up. Why were you?
It's a good question. I had a pretty privileged, you know, upbringing. Nothing really to be angry about in any kind of like concrete way that a lot of people could say, like, you know, they had to face adversity in various ways. I think there's something that happens, not to every adolescent, but it kind of should happen, where the world is sort of revealed to you and you realize that it's much more stupid and mean than you were educated to believe growing up. And this is where a lot of angry music and bad haircuts come from. And a lot of that, I think, with age, it's a good idea to find context and to kind of like forgive the world some of its hypocrisies and to understand the compromises that created the way things are. But there's a piece of that that's worth hanging on to that I think some people let slide, because there's an idealism to it that, like, it shouldn't be this stupid. And there shouldn't be such a lie about it being things making more sense and working better than they actually do. And that's worth holding on to. That's the best part of teenagers.
As hair metal gives way to pop, gives way to grunge, so too has the media shifted since those Punch days. But your tone hasn't really. Last time I was on, I said I was worried that you've cynicked yourself into a corner. And what is the long play? Is it hard to remain cynical? Where do you find the stamina for that?
It's so easy. It's terribly easy. Look, we're both parents, and I think you can't be cynical and be a parent. But if anything, that just like actually makes you more invested in, I don't know, wanting things to be better.
Well, I would argue as a parent, one thing that changed in my life is I want things to be simpler. I want to be around more. I get a lot of invitations to be a guest on people's podcasts, for example. I feel like time is my wealth, and the more of it I have, the better I feel. So I can only imagine if you're angry in your life and work, that's hard, isn't it?
I just want to back up a bit. Are you suggesting that you're hard to book on podcasts, that you're like a get?
No, I'm not. But everyone who's like, you know what? My grampy and I started a podcast in the barn and we thought it would be real fun to have you on. I'm those like a fun first guest. I get a lot of those asks.
Right, right.
We've never actually done one, but we'd love to have you. Like, do your kids have to call you Jesse Brown?
No. Let me answer your actual question. What was your actual question? Is it hard to be angry?
That's sort of the headline. Is it hard to sustain cynicism? You've been cynical for decades. Isn't that exhausting?
Yes, it is. But I know no other way. I think that anger and frustration, and I don't mean to say that it's simply about like the hypocrisies of the world. Like, you know, like anger is a very personal thing. And I think that some stuff gets implanted in you very early. And yeah, there's parts of it where you kind of have to maybe put away childish things and try to be at peace. But then there's also, I don't know, like, what's your juice? What's your fuel? Like, you keep returning to this idea of cynicism, but to try to keep this operation of this company going every day, it's like, I once heard a film producer talk about, like, what is producing? And it's like, everything wants to collapse always. And the natural state of any endeavor is for it to fall apart and just not function. And we function and we put these things out on time. And some of them are really, really good. And every day is like, all right, let's get behind that boulder. And just like, it might like roll downhill and roll over my feet today, or I might get it like another inch closer to wherever it is we're going. And that's a whole interesting thing to think about too, because I don't really think about getting it to the top. I don't really think about selling the company or retiring. It's this thing of like, I guess I'm just going to do this forever. So I don't know how you could be cynical and wake up and do that every day.
I remember a friend of mine, Roger Fredericks, who's a TV writer, saying making a film is like 50 people trying to draw a straight line with a giant pencil. And I've never forgotten that. I love that image so much.
Yeah, that's good.
Do you think the Jesse Brown that people perceive is close to who you really are? Like, I remember Wayne Gretzky saying, there's Wayne Gretzky and that's the Enterprise. And then at home, there's Wayne. And it's a very different thing. And that's how he compartmentalizes those two things. Do you think Jesse Brown, in quotes, is a good representation of you?
Yeah, like to an extent. You don't get everything and you don't want everything. And it's important for me and for people in my life that it's not everything. So you kind of have to decide what to hold back. But I live in fear of constructing something that's false and then having to maintain it. It's not about any kind of integrity. It's just about, like, that seems like a lot of work. When we think about certain broadcasters who really put up a front, like a version of themselves that nobody really experiences in real life, that must be exhausting, you know? I've also, like, it's less so these days, because I think that the show is less about me than it ever was, but what was exciting about podcasting to me in the early days was that there's so many parts of conversation or of like what you're thinking or just like being a little bit mean or the little parts where everybody's like rustling in their seat before the interview gets going. All the real life that got kind of smoothed away from like a slick CBC interview back when I was hosting at CBC. And when podcasting was new, part of the excitement of it for me was like, you know, I've given up my dreams of being an artist, you know, but like I am a communicator and I do express myself. I wonder if a podcast can be a medium to express like a lot of myself. And so there were like interviews with people from my personal life and old friends. And, you know, like the early episodes had like people I dated and enemies and things. So I just was wondering, like, could the interview format sustain all that stuff? Overall, a lot of me has gotten onto this RSS feed.
People do come after you hard, though. That is no secret. My father-in-law always says there are givers and takers. Givers sleep better, but takers eat better. In an interview with Sarah Berman on the show last year, you alluded to deep-seated personality flaws that have cost you friends, sleep, and well-being. But you also conceded that you might be a lot poorer if you were a better person, in quotes. What did you mean by that?
I know which of my colleagues fed you that question, too, just by the content of it. What did I mean by that? Wow. I don't remember the context. Like it's hard for me to sort through my deep-seated personality flaws and recall which one I was referring to. And if I was a better person, I probably would be less wealthy. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that would seem like a funny thing to say at the time, but like, I don't know. To what extent does being like a less good person?
Well, I guess I'll say in your defense that does speak to someone who has a self-awareness. Is that maybe something you don't show enough? That you get it.
Yeah. You know, I don't know why I came on this show. Who's even listening to this? Okay, so it is very self-indulgent, but I guess that this whole episode is, and I agreed to this. I'm a part of this, so I'll go with you here. I think that one thing that I've learned just from, like, covering people is that denial is a really powerful thing, and people's blind spots, like this idea of like a search for truth, and you know the interview is a kind of a cross-examination where you try to get at it. There is no one who is not oblivious to some aspect of themselves, which is like totally apparent to everybody else. So I try to be self-aware without being like annoyingly self-obsessed, but I'm sure that there's like some very obvious stuff that that I just don't see.
I didn't really hear anything you said after everyone has a blind spot about which they are blissfully unaware and everyone else knows it. I'm trying to think of what mine is. I've been accused of having a crippling desire to be liked. Like that's the other side of this coin, the burden of kindness. How I am keenly aware that people are hoping to have a negative interaction with me because they can't wait to tell everyone what a jerk I was at Sobeys.
That's not your blind spot at all. That's immediately apparent.
Do you know what mine is?
Yeah, you're angry.
Yeah, I am. I'm really angry. There must be kind of a freedom in that, though, isn't there? Well, everyone thinks I'm angry anyway, I might as well just be angry.
Yes. Yes. I find it very liberating not to have to hide. You know, I'm sure that I'm crippled from having to hide other things. But it does feel like it's better for me as a media critic, or, you know, and as an interviewer, if I don't care about what people think of me. You know, it was always like a latent part of my personality that my friends saw that I could be kind of nasty or cutting. But, you know, there's truth to it. So it was definitely freeing when I could just say what I felt, you know. It was fun. It was fun.
But in that quote, when you say you've lost friends and sleep, is that true? Does that weigh on you?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. There have been occasions where I have felt like if I'm worth anything as a critic or as somebody's trying to tell the truth, sometimes it's like I can't just criticize people I don't know or don't like. Sometimes I felt like it's necessary here for me to say something critical about somebody who I am friends with or work with or something like that. And that has led to conflict and hurt feelings and broken relationships. And I've definitely, in cases, felt like, did I talk myself into that this was noble or honest, or was it a performance of honesty and uncompromising truth, and I sacrificed a friendship to perform that, or did it need to be done? And some of those questions remain open for me.
When the pandemic started, you published isolation interviews on this show. In one of them, you mentioned you have a hard time with empathy.
Is there a question there?
Well, there's more of an ellipsis there. I was trying to not do a sort of CBC radio. Can you talk about that, or walk me through that, or what does that feel like? I guess I was just going to lay it on the table and see if you picked up the verbal baton in any way that suited you.
I'll let your ellipsis hang. I think that I have like decent EQ. I think I'm literate and aware of people's emotions. And I hope to be like an ethical, like I care about how people feel. I try to anyhow, but I don't think I feel what people feel. I think that maybe I've made an asset in this job out of like, I'm willing to let things be really uncomfortable in a way that like it feels so awkward, or people feel so bad for somebody else when they're in a tough spot that, you know, you can't ask certain questions or have certain conversations. So anyhow, a lot of like what I've tried to do professionally is purpose the things that are maybe not great about my personality towards a positive outcome or towards a service that I could provide. But if you're asking me, like, do you not feel empathy? Like, the nerves aren't dead. And certainly, you know, family and parenthood has, you know, that brings things right to the surface. But I question, like, you know, that word has become so popular these days, to be empathetic. But like, let's be moral. How about that? Let's actually make decisions that take people's feelings into consideration, because there's no prize for feeling bad on behalf of somebody else, you know, or like in reflection of somebody else. Like that, like, it doesn't really accomplish anything that you feel someone else's pain or joy or whatever they feel. It's become its own kind of bullshit.
Has parenthood kind of shaken you out of that?
Out of my like lack of empathy, or out of my or into a greater understanding of EQ? Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, their needs are immediate and unrelenting.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the things you like to do with your kids?
Well, I mean, here is...
This is where it's going to get uncomfortable.
It's not going to... I mean, this is... It's not uncomfortable for me so much as, like, that's what I leave off the table. You know, they just don't have a choice if I'm going to involve them in my public whatever. So, I don't know. The deal I've made with my partner and my kind of implicit deal with them is, like, this is going to be your choice, whether you want to be associated with any of this or not, or your life to be reflected. Like, as soon as you say anything about them, they exist in people's minds. And then that becomes something that they might later have to deal with, is the way in which, I mean, it's something that I have to deal with, and that, like, anybody who listens to me has an understanding of me, and then they meet me and are terribly disappointed, and we have to deal with that. But I chose that, and they, you know, they didn't.
I live in the country. My life is very quiet by design, but I do like to visit the noise on occasion. How much of the noise appeals to you?
Oh, my God.
Like, do you go to the Giller Awards and the stuff and the dinners, and you have to show up at a thing? Do you like all that?
Man, I go to things like journalism event galas pretty much anytime I'm invited. And I love walking into the room and just feeling like, I'm sure I'm imagining it, you know, 99 out of 100 of the people have no idea who I am, but I'm like, oh, there's so much hate and there's so much enmity towards me. And I've written about this one and that one. Like, and then people are lovely and say nice things and are like, oh, it's great to see Canada Land doing so well. I'm going to tell you a story about the last one I went to.
Please do.
All right. This was like the Canadian Journalism Fund gala, and it was like half journalists and it was half the money people who give money to this fund. And they, you know, what do? They give money to, you know, some foreign correspondent who's being driven out of their home country in South America. And aren't they brave? And they are. And so RBC or somebody gives them some money. And then there's internships for kids, and all the wonderful people who are brave journalists get, you know, grants and get little videos about their wonderful work. And Matt Galloway's hosting, and he gives an award to David Suzuki, and David Suzuki is introduced by Margaret Atwood, and Margaret Atwood says nice things about Suzuki, and then Ed Bertinsky. It's all of the good, fine people of Canada just congratulating each other on how wonderful and good they are and giving each other awards. And I'm invited. I don't know why I'm invited. I mean, maybe to spice things up. But then once you've got me there, you've got a problem, which is like, where do you seat me? You know, like, that could be an issue if you put me at the wrong table. And who can even keep track of the various journalists and editors who have taken umbrage with me and are reporting over the years? So where do they seat me, Jono? They sat me at the student journalist table.
Amazing.
Which, like, that's great. They're like, it's a great way to meet people who might be looking for jobs and have great stories to pitch. But then we get to the part of the evening where Matt Galloway turns to the audience and says, you know, all of you wonderful people, you journalists brave and funders of brave journalists, thank you. But there's still one more thing to do. There's something here for one of you lucky people. Look under your chair. One of you will find an envelope with a special gift. It's tickets, airplane tickets to anywhere Porter flies. And I look underneath my chair while everyone else is, and God damn it, I got the envelope.
No!
And it only occurred to me later that they put it at the student journalism table so a student journalist would get it. And Galloway says, who got it? Who got it? Who got it? Somebody must have got it.
Anybody find the envelope? The envelope remains in an undisclosed location.
And I'm just like, oh, shit. And the students see the envelope in my hand, and the students start yelling to Matt Galloway, over here, Jesse won, Jesse won. And then like a spotlight is right in my face, and the entire room turns towards me, and Matt Galloway, who is just unflappable and classy, goes,
oh, there we are. Oh, Jesse Brown gets the envelope. There's a story in that somewhere.
And there's just this, I'm just like, and I'm sorry, everybody. I'm so sorry that I won the tickets. And everyone looks appalled. And it was the greatest gift. It was the greatest thing I could have won. Better than the David Suzuki.
Where did you go?
I didn't go anywhere.
You gave it to one of the kids.
I had to give it away or else it would look bad. I'm not.
Yeah, but also as a human being, that's the right thing to do in that moment.
The right thing to do is to go on a trip and have fun. We've been locked up for 2 years. I still think about those tickets.
When I was on the show last time, here, let's revisit this. You mocked the song I wrote for Canada's 150 celebrations,
mm-hmm.
Which was a re-lyriced version of Alanis's Thank You.
How about finding a way to say Canada thank you?
Thank you.
Prairies and mountains and tundra and sea.
Thank you.
But I also explained to you why it was the worst thing ever, and then you agreed. We got somewhere.
I did. Yeah, we really did. It was all of the cliches that we roll our collective eyes at, for better or for worse. Your point is worse, and I totally see how it's worse, and I totally understand how that wasn't everyone's experience. I mean, this is the thing. When people talk about COVID and we're all in it together, someone who's in a bachelor condo at Bay and Bloor had a very different experience than I did. So it's the same as traveling internationally. When people say, what is Canada like? You can't describe what it's like. You can only describe what it's like for yourself. But you asked me what Canadianity is, which is the sort of word that Jeremy Taggart and I use on our podcast, Taggart.
It's the word that you made up, yeah.
A word that we made up. So you made up a word too, Canada Land.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
I think I just like the way it sounded. Like I've heard people talk about like when people talk about Chicago politics, like, there's a wonderful sense of place in a lot of American storytelling and journalism, you know, fiction and nonfiction, where, like, New York has a certain meaning and California, you can sing songs about these places and they have, like, this, like, deep resonance. And we just can't do that. You can be like, yeah, that's Winnipeg hard. You know, like, we just don't take ourselves seriously to an extent that that becomes possible. So anyhow, I've heard people talk about Chicagoland in this way that I always just found, like, felt really lurid and interesting and engaging to me. Like, what is, like, it, and it just is suggestive of this deep, sprawling corruption and, you know, forget it, it's Chicagoland.